That again is right here, right now, today. How many of you in the room know a rich Indian? Now, I'm not talking about Bill Gates rich or even Rockefeller rich. Nobody ought to be that rich. But as the dominant society, as the settler society computes wealth, this is a wealthy group on paper. That's the nominal situation. What's the practical reality? Well, I've been using government data to paint the profile thus far. So for consistency's sake, allow me to continue to use government's data. American Indians, according to the government's data, right now, still, again, today, keep things in a current framework. It wouldn't have been different 25 years ago, and it wouldn't have been different 50 years ago. Okay, but right now, in the year 2001, American Indians are far and away the poorest population aggregate overall on the continent, experiencing the lowest lifetime and annual incomes, the highest rate of unemployment. I won't belabor you with the whole data set. The upshot of that is that you have a set of conditions. Okay, let me go to this impoverishment. Let me simply say this. We're not talking about being poor in the sense that you can't buy a new car when you decide to. We're not talking about not being able to change houses and upgrade. We're not talking about anything that relates to an advanced industrial state's sense of impoverishment. We're talking about people living on the Pine Ridge Reservation on a per capita income of $2,000 a year. You're talking third world level in poverty, right smack dab in the middle of the United States. You're talking unemployment rates that are not uncomfortable, but catastrophic. You're talking about 90th percentile unemployment on Pine Ridge every year for the last 50 years. You're talking about 60th percentile unemployment for Native America as a whole. That's the nature of it. And that computes into certain other factors as well. Sticking still with the federal data, you find that American Indians experience the highest rate of death from things like exposure and malnutrition. You find that American Indians experience the highest rate of death from things like infant mortality, 14 times the national average. You find that American Indians experience the highest rate of death by decisive margins with readily curable communicable diseases, and also rates of death that are unparalleled anywhere else in North American society from things like plague disease. Cut to the chase on that, you have reservation-based American Indian men experiencing a life expectancy of about 44 and a half years at the turn of the millennium. You find American Indian women living on reservations have a life expectancy about 3 years longer. And that sounds like maybe American Indian women are doing better than their men. But then you peg the male longevity statistics of American Indians against that of the general population male, which is 71.8 years, okay? And you do the same with a female, and you find that the female in the general population outlives the male by approximately 8 years on average, and therefore, proportionately, American Indian women are actually doing worse than the men, although they're living 3 years longer on average. They have a five-year greater deficit in terms of longevity as compared to their non-Indian sisters overall. These are longevity data that would be applicable to the overall American population in 1890. So we're a century behind the rest of the country in terms of quality of life, as they call it in San Francisco. And you might want to make the connection between the vaunted quality of life in San Francisco on the one hand and the degradation of living standards on American Indian reservations on the other, because there is a direct relationship between those two things. As Eduardo Galeano put it with respect to North America and the southern cone of South America, your wealth, he said, is our poverty, and that's exactly and equivalently applicable to the relationship between the dominant or the settler society on the one hand and Native North America on the other. Now, how does that work? That works off the basis of something that was articulated most clearly in the Lone Wolf opinion of the Supreme Court in 1903, when the court announced unilaterally and rather arbitrarily, but drawing on some historical precedent, that the United States enjoyed a plenary authority over American Indians. That translated into normal people's talk means that they have an absolute and unchallengeable authority to make decisions in behalf of Indians. okay?